Do you find yourself drawn to the underdog? You find yourself identifying with them and rooting for them? I do. And I don't think that I stand much attention was given to the World Series, much more than usual, I believe, because there were two underdogs that were fighting for world championship status. And the poor Chicago Cubs hadn't been the world champions since 1908. That's several generations. So I think that they were sort of America's favorite in the World Series. Being here in Corvallis and being part of the Beaver Nation, we certainly have a lot of practice at being the underdog. So if you're given to identifying with the underdog and rooting for the underdog, then I think you will have no trouble warming up to the Old Testament lesson. The Old Testament lesson deals with the kingdom of Israel in Old Testament times. Israel was a small country, a small nation. It was a proverbial doormat. There was a superpower on the west called Egypt, and there was superpowers on the east that varied with time. Times they were the Assyrians, times they were the Babylons. But in those days, the standard way to grow your national product was to build your army and go out and conquer neighboring countries and relieve those countries of their wealth. That's the way it was done. Here is poor Israel between the superpowers trying to guess in the next war who should we try to side with so as to minimize our chances of being stomped too badly. In the Old Testament lesson, Jeremiah the prophet, we read from Jeremiah the prophet. The prophets were also there at the time of the kings, and the prophets were special individuals, men and women, who were given messages by God, and they were required to speak to their countrymen, even speak to their king. And more often than not, those messages were bitter messages. This is a bitter message that was read. Imagine if you were the king and Jeremiah shows up and says, "We're about to be stomped, and you know what? The reason we're about to stomp is because you've done such a poor job shepherding your people." It was a hard life being a prophet. On one occasion, Jeremiah says, "I wish I would have never been born." Pretty hard life. Well, there is strong element of hope in what Jeremiah says. Jeremiah says, there will be a new king coming, and this new king will be a different king. This king will be the King of Kings, because this will be a king of righteousness. Fast forward now, 6 centuries or thereabout, to the gospel lesson from Luke. We're on a hill just outside of Jerusalem. There's a stout timber rising from the ground, and on that timber is a sign, the King of the Jews. Luke and the other evangelists do not go into great detail about the crucifixion. By and large, they say they crucified him. But we know a great deal about crucifixions because of the writings of Roman historians who lived during this time that still exist. And we even have a Jewish historian who lived at this time of Jesus whose writings still exist. So we know something about crucifixions. Crucifixion was a very, very terrible thing. So terrible that the Romans, who viewed themselves as being very civilized, would not allow a crucifixion to take place in their own land, their own country. If anybody was going to be crucified, it had to take place in the countries that they had conquered. And then, if somebody was to be crucified, it could not be a Roman. Romans were exempt from crucifixions. Only non-Romans could be crucified. The leather straps of the whip contained bones. And when the person to be crucified was beaten, he was beaten harshly so as to pierce the body's skin and to produce a great deal of blood and to begin the process of weakening the person to be crucified. Crucified person then was required to be the center of attention in a parade. In this parade, there was a soldier in front of the person to be crucified, a Roman soldier at the rear, and a Roman soldier on either side. And the person to be crucified carried the cross member of the cross. They didn't go to the site of the crucifixion by a direct route. Rather, they turned it into a parade and went through as many streets as they could, because one of the purposes of the crucifixion was to make sure that everybody but everybody saw what was happening. The Romans reasoned that if the Jews saw what was happening, they would think twice, maybe three or four times, before they would do something that would likely cause the displeasure of the Romans. So when they arrive at the site of the crucifixion, the upright is taken down, cross member is affixed to it. Now, on this upright, there is attached a saddle. And the purpose of the saddle is so that much of the weight of the person being crucified is on the saddle, because if that were not true and all the weight was on those nails in the hands, then what could happen is that eventually the weight would cause the flesh to tear apart and the person would fall down. Now, most of us think of crucifixion as something that takes place in the course of a day, but that's not the case. Most crucifixions were several-day affairs. It took that long for the person to die. And even after the person died, they didn't remove the person from the cross. They just left the corpse on the cross and let the raptors and other animals have at it. In the case of Jesus' crucifixion, he died within the course of the day, and his body was taken down from the cross in order not to offend Jewish law regarding the Sabbath. I think it was about 10 years ago, Mel Gibson produced a movie dealing with the crucifixion of Jesus. And I've heard that it's very, very realistic. It's very, very intense. I've never seen it. And I think that the reason I've never seen it is because I've avoided seeing it. And I tell myself that the reason I've avoided seeing it is because I'm a squeamish person. I'm not sure that I could take it. But you know, there's another explanation, an explanation worth considering. When we come to the foot of the cross, we see ourselves and our sinful nature in a totally stark manner. We see our pride. We see our indifference to others. We see all of the things that we do wrong. Nothing brings us to the core of our sinful nature like standing at the cross, at the foot of the cross of Jesus. Maybe that's the reason I haven't been able to bring. I assume it's readily available on Netflix, but I haven't viewed it. Martin Luther, in his writings, differentiates between two theologies. One theology he calls a theology of glory, and the other theology he calls a theology of the cross. The theology of glory is one to which Americans like you and me can readily warm up to. It's a theology that says, I can do it. I'm a creative, ingenious person. The main thing you can do for me is not get in my way. I can take care of myself. I'm independent. I don't need help. Maybe some other people need help, but I don't need help. The theology of glory, there's no need for a cross. The problem with the theology of glory, Martin Luther said, was that it's dead wrong. Rather than a theology of glory, the scriptures and Martin Luther championed a theology of the cross. The theology of the cross is one that is just strewn with apparent contradictions. Here we have a majestic God who is humiliated and shamed. Here we have an all-powerful God who exercises weakness. Here we have a God who dies, and the theology of the cross has a God who suffers so that we might have the resurrection. Contradiction after contradiction. Well, humans just can't come to a God who is humiliated, suffers, and dies. Can't grasp a God like that. The Apostle Paul says that the cross was a stumbling block to the Jew, and it was folly to the Greeks. It's no different today. Humans simply can't warm up to a God who is humiliated, who suffers, and who dies. And yet we're here this morning. How is it that we're here this morning? We're all human. Well, it happened in the waters of baptism. There was a miracle. God created faith in you, and he created faith in me. And that faith has been nurtured and sustained over the year by family and friends who've shared with us the word. That faith that we have today is being nurtured and sustained when we listen to the scriptures and jointly respond, thanks be to God. Thanks be to God. Sharon and I have been blessed with good friends over our many years. One such friend are the Moons. Shang Moon was an orphan during the Korean War. And he was befriended by a Lutheran chaplain who somehow managed to bring Sean to the United States. He was educated at Lutheran schools and colleges and at a Lutheran seminary. Shang Moon and I were colleagues for a number of years, at least 40 years ago. The Moon share our enthusiasm for our national parks and for photography. We rendezvous with them every couple of years. Maybe about 2 years ago, we were together at the Canyonlands National Park, and we're hiking. And when we hike, we talk about all kinds of things, not just photography. And Moon says, you know, we Lutherans do a very, very good job with justification, but we're not so great when it comes to sanctification. Now, justification is the process by which we come to faith. Sanctification is the process by which, after coming to faith, we then attempt to become more like Christ. As I thought about what Moon said that afternoon, I thought, you know, I think he has a point. I hadn't quite thought of it in those terms before, but I wouldn't disagree with him. Well, I thought of that while working with the gospel lesson. There is a point in the gospel lesson that just says, this is a time to talk sanctification. So let's talk sanctification. Jesus is suffering an intense, terrible form of death. And what does he do? He forgives his tormentors. Now, forgiveness is not a human trait. The human trait is that someone wrongs you, you become angry, you want to see that person suffer just like you have suffered, and then we think of that as justice. That's what it means to be human. Now, all of us here have been wronged on many occasions. I'm quite confident of that. Sometimes we've been wronged with, it's almost a scratch, not a real wound. Other times we've been wounded to the core. I was thinking about, I think I was in either second or third grade. It was gym time. Our teacher said, the boys will play softball. Our teacher then picked two boys to be the captains, and the captains were to choose among their various classmates and come up with two teams that were going to play each other. Well, as you would expect, The captains began choosing the boys who were better at softball so that they would have a strong team. Well, eventually there were only two or three of us left. And one captain says, "We don't want them. You can have them." Now that's 65 years ago, at least. And I still remember it. And that's just a scratch, right? Kind of cute. I can readily talk about that. Some real wounds I wouldn't be able to talk about. They would be too deep, too personal, too difficult to share. But these wounds keep rolling through our memories. Roll and roll and roll. They don't go away. They're there. Well, what is the Jesus-like thing is to forgive. When we forgive someone who has wounded us, we walk in stride with Jesus. When we forgive, we walk in stride with Jesus. Now, while we're walking in stride with Jesus, let's not forget about paradise. As we walk towards Jesus, our walk with Jesus, we're looking for that hand that says, "Come into my paradise, come into my garden, and be my companion." Now, even for a non-gardener like me, that's a beautiful image. Pray that you will leave today with that image in your mind. Jesus is awaiting us, that garden, King of Kings, with his hand out, saying, "You are my companion." So be it. Amen.